welcome to yet another episode of the Dungeon Masters.
I'll be running the show today with a friend of mine. He'll be joining us in just a couple minutes here, as Sebastian is finishing up his move cross country. Not gonna lie, things are crazy out there. But Ryman Frostmaiden just dropped today, and we're gonna be talking about some deeply nerdy things you can do to stay entertained and safe in your home. Boom. Welcome back to another episode of the Dungeon Masters. I'm joined here this week by my good friend, fellow Dungeon Master in both respects. That goes by Deacon. Well, you can see.
Howdy. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Very good to have you. We were talking the other night, and you shared with me what I have to say is probably one of the most inspired expansions on any pre-written campaign setting that I've seen to date. The Curse of Strahd campaign setting, and I've been trying to scroll back through our Facebook message history to find it, and we talked for a very long time.
Well,
I will share that link on Dungeon Masters podcast website and all of our socials, because people really need to see this. You put a ton of work into it, and it's beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah, it's up on Reddit, so if people want to check it out and upvote it, that'll make me happy. It was, as I said in the post, a bit of a love letter from my partner, who's part of the campaign, and it ended up being my player's like favorite addition that I made to Curse of Strahd, and I hope that other people enjoy it as much as we did.
There we go. I finally found it. The Trees of the Four Seasons is what you call it. You're going to give us just a little bit of background on where this came from and the short form version of what people can read in the post.
Sure. Where it came from, it was a very organic development. It started when the party had fought the Night Hags of the Old Bone Grinder.
Love Old Bone Grinder.
That was a fun encounter. I kidnapped a child from Valaki that he'd grown fond of in order to MacGuffin them into it. After killing the hags, they were just sort of like checking out the area around the windmill. They came across the megaliths outside, which have the carvings of the four cities and the four seasons. The space had been desecrated by the Night Hags, though, notably not in the formalized version of the desecrate spell. It was just, like trash and shit around. My partner, who's playing a druid, was like, well, clearly as a druid, I should like cleanse the space and, kind of get it back to a feeling of being a sacred space. So they cleaned it up, and then they cast Plant Growth. And I decided to give it a little bit of extra flavor, it grew a whole kind of grove of trees around the megaliths, behind the summer city were some trees in foliage of summer. Behind the fall megalith, there was, fall colors, with like a smooth gradient going all the way around. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of what planted the initial seed.
Pun intended.
Not initially intended, but I'm claiming it now. That was where it first started. And what really kept pushing it along was, honestly, a bit of a feeling of dissatisfaction with the treatment in the campaign materials of the like deeper history of the valley with respect to like the druids and the hill barbarians. It felt like there was a lot of room for that to be further developed. What was in the campaign materials just felt like, it felt incomplete and not super well fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it all kind of developed very organically from there. But the general gist of what the kind of background lore is that, so the, when Barovia was still in the prime material plane, it, was at the convergence of ley lines.
Mm-hmm.
And those ley lines, you know, provided a high concentration of magical energy in the valley that made it especially lush, especially green, especially verdant and full mm-hmm. of life.
And an especially good target.
Yeah. And in that time, there were four giant trees, one tree for each season, that were sort of like the protector spirits of the nature in the valley. And then, of course, that high concentration of magical energy is what attracted the wizards to the valley to make the Amber Temple. And that is kind of where things continue to spiral out in order to, you know, ultimately end up with Strahd in the valley.
That is a great additional background on that. You're touching on something, too, that I've heard from, you know, many of our friends who are DMs in this context, in running pre-written campaign stuff, and also Rime of the Frostmaiden. This book is amazing and dense. Can't wait to get into it. But the idea that pre-written campaigns have to be followed exactly is something I've never agreed with, and what you're describing is exactly why. You know, there are aspects to each of these campaign books and each of the pre-written sections where you as the DM have complete agency to just take the reins of something that is interesting, especially to your group in particular, and just fucking run with it. Like, getting weird with something, and especially in that one, when we played it, we also had a druid who, in many ways, was like, cool, what is the nature doing here? Because as written, pretty much the entire place is just under the sway, under the control of this one, you know, vampire lord. So you run into some wolves in the woods, and it's like, guess what? There's Strahd's wolves. Like, can't really talk to them. Fuck off.
Yeah.
But giving that extra tie-in, giving that extra connection, really makes it more dynamic, much more interesting, and it leads to your players, I'm sure, having a much better time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my players all feel like the bits that I've added to the campaign have been their favorite parts. And, you know,
this... Good compliment.
Yeah, thank you. So this, notably, this campaign was my first time DMing. And you know, when we first started out, I was super nervous and was sticking to the source materials pretty closely.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I got increasingly like, hey, I could build off of this. The first breakthrough on that was, the Sun Sword was with the Vistani encampment outside of Valaki.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you're supposed to get the item from them, is basically like you find the guy's daughter and bring it back and they just give you the sword. And I'm like, these bandits work for Strahd. Like, it should be harder than that for them to betray their master who has a lot of sway in this valley. The Vistani invited the party to a celebratory feast. My party failed their insight checks, so even though my players are very good at not metagaming, so when they failed their insight checks, they ran with it.
Yep.
And they were ambushed. The Voctors showed up, who they had previously, you know, foiled their attempt at a coup in Valaki, so they had like an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, most of the players escaped, but the bard was taken captive and there was this epic chase scene. And then the bit of the old bone grinder happened right after that. So this was right at the start of when I started to take control of the narrative and kind of expand on the written materials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds awesome. Yeah, there's, when we ran it, when I was running it as a player, that was something that our friend Steve, who ran it for us, frequently would say after, you know, the campaign was ending. He was like, mm-hmm. oh yeah, you guys like that? Like, I just kind of made that up. Like, there were a lot of little tie-in moments that didn't exist. You know, there were so many, there's so many ways to weave the storylines together that I almost feel like in most of the pre-written campaigns, which, by the way, great choice for your first time DMing.
Thank you.
Curse of Strahd, one of my favorites, like, of all time. Fucking fantastic. In both its simplicity and its complexity. Like, at its heart, it's a very simple premise. Mm-hmm. It's the story everyone knows. It's like, yeah, there's a vampire lord. He's up on that fucking castle. He wants this girl. You've got to protect that girl. Go. You also have to survive and maybe escape.
Yeah.
You know? And if you can do those things, like, the campaign can progress around it.
Mm-hmm.
Something like, we just finished up Tomb of Annihilation. That one's a little more loose, but it's still, it's a story everybody knows. Like, yep, there's an ancient lich. There's some shit going on. The world is being sucked into darkness. You're the heroes. Figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in many of these pre-written campaigns, I think they've done a really good job, whether intentionally or not, of leaving so much up to the individual DM's discretion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here's the bones. Here's some flesh. Now put your own skin on it and we'll see what it looks like.
Yeah. I mean, that is almost exactly the way that I would have put it. You know, having a skeleton to work off of was extremely useful for a first time DM, you know, like I had always been intimidated by the prospect of having to like invent a world or learn a very intricate existing one. Like Faerun is just like, there's so much there. You know, having to kind of come up with all of that from scratch while also like learning the mechanics of how to DM was just like really overwhelming. And props again to my partner for being like, well, why don't you just start with one of the pre-written campaigns? And we went to what's the name of the gaming store on Divisadero?
Gamescape! Shout out to Gamescape. I was there literally earlier today picking this up.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, we sat there leafing through all of the campaign books.
Remember when you could sit in a place and like page through books?
Oh my God, I barely do. It was down to either Strahd or Storm King's Thunder. And we went with Strahd.
Strahd was a good choice. As somebody who's also running Storm King's Thunder right now, Strahd was a great choice.
I've heard there's some pretty huge holes in Storm King.
There are enormous, giant-sized holes in Storm King. But more importantly, if the idea of learning world lore while learning DMing was daunting, definitely a good idea to pick the one that takes place in a realm of dread that's like this big and not the one that takes place across the entire northern continent.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot more.
Yeah. There's literally an entire section of the book that just lists notable towns and cities, and it's like 30 pages long.
Jesus.
Each one with like, here's little quest hooks, here's little NPCs, like here's locations, here's a mini map of stuff that can happen. Here's encounters. It's fucking bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds crazy. Sounds crazy. Of course, now that we're moving into, so the party wants to keep our story going after Strahd,
because
they're all really invested in the characters. And so I've chosen to, I'm retconning a little bit, because, you know, we originally met up in Daggerford, and I'm like, actually, guys, fuck that. We met up in Zadash.
Nice.
Because Explorer's Guide to Wildemount just came out not too long ago, and I am a huge fan of Critical Role. Matt Mercer has taught me so much about how to be a good DM, especially because during my 3.5-month migraine in the fall, I basically just like spent all day stoned off my gourd listening to Crit Roll. I went through all of campaign one in like 2.5 months, maybe.
Yeah.
Like 300 some odd hours.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. When I came back from Burning Man after I broke this finger in Thunderdome, I was just high as balls on fucking pain meds and weed, and I was like, I'm gonna watch all of the Critical Role, because fuck it.
Yep.
The same thing. Like, you know, 12 hours a day, you crush through like 3 episodes a day.
Yep.
And you just keep on rolling through.
Yep. Yep. It was, you know, it was a great thing to kind of tie it along when there was nothing else you could do. Mm-hmm. And you know, that crew is just amazing. The collaborative storytelling that goes on there is some of the best I've ever encountered, if not the best.
Yeah, it's truly exceptional. I mean, granted, and here's the thing, the Critical Role effect, as many people have noted and seen, it's like, never judge yourself by the fact that these professional voice actors are able to do this so well. These are exceptionally talented human beings who are doing something that in some ways is probably like second nature. Like, that's literally their job. They do all the time, dropping into voices. So especially as a new DM, like, don't hold yourself to the same standard, but aspire, you know? Because I've seen so many wonderful and horrible stories online of people who are like getting new groups and they're like, well, that's not how Matt would do it. It's like, man, that's not how that table, while exceptional, is not every table, nor should it be.
No, it's like trying to compare like a pickup game of football with your buddies to the NFL, right? It's just like, it's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like some people are professionals. Mm-hmm. They're really good at what they do, and it's an amazing beauty to watch them. You know, they're artists.
Mm-hmm.
And then that doesn't mean we can't create too, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Although one thing I will sort of like dust my shoulders off about is that I am actually a pretty solid voice actor myself. Aspire to maybe do it someday professionally, but it's been really fun coming up with different voices for the various characters.
Fuck yeah.
Like Krej is, for our campaign at least, like the most interesting, maybe not interesting, but the most pleasant part of all of Barovia. It was, you know, definitely their favorite spot because, you know, there's actually some semblance of like stable life there. Mm-hmm. And so I fleshed it out with a couple of good characters like Burgomaster Krejkov, the voice that was a little bit like a combination of Sean Connery with a Eastern European accent.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the hooks that I used to get them into Krejk in the first place was our halfling paladin rides around on a pig named Pimpernel, who's his trusty steed. And Pimpernel, you know, he's a pig. He's squishy. And they wanted armor for him. And so all of the smiths in Vallaki were like, ooh, making armor for a pig. I don't know about that.
Yeah, armor for a pig. Nope, not in Vallaki.
Yeah, but we've heard that there's this really great smith named Smithy in Krejk. Right, and so they went to Krejk and they finally met up with Smithy. And Smithy talked like this. They first met him in the tavern. He'd been a little bit deep in his cups at the time, didn't quite understand what it was they were all talking about. All talking at once, something about a pig didn't make sense. He was like, yeah, you want me to wrestle the pig? And they were like, wait, hold on, we'll come back to that. This is what we actually want. And yes, we want you to wrestle the pig. And so our rogue did a sleight of hand check to pull out a flask of lantern oil and grease the pig. That moment was really inspired by like Grog in the fighting pits in campaign one, where it was just this back and forth of basically contested grapple checks.
Yep.
And the pig got advantage on escaping because he was greased.
Yep.
It was super fun.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. That sounds like it's one of those moments where, as a DM, like, you're running with what your players are throwing at you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, I know what you actually want, but, like, how are you getting to the point here? And then when you're in character, you get to have those really fun moments, too, of being like,
well, you want me to wrestle a pig?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, they're all talking over each other. It's like, this is confusing, guys. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Like, both as a character and as a DM, you're like, I actually, like, 8 of you were talking at once. Like, I don't, what is your plan?
Yeah.
Especially, and this is something that, like, our groups have generally gotten around by saying, all conversations are in character unless you specifically say you're not. Like, mm-hmm. unless you're specifically like, hold on, out of character, like, I have a question. You know, everything you say, and also every drink you have is in character. So if you're somebody like me who likes to just sit around and casually, like, drink at 5 o'clock in the evening, like, guess what? Your character has a flask. It is doing the same.
Nice. So
if you end up in, like, some highly charged political situation at 11:30 p.m. and you're kind of toasted, guess what? Your character is too. Good luck with that disadvantage on charisma checks. Or advantage if you can say it right.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
So that's one of the things that helps to, like, take away some of the crosstalk for our groups,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that I've noticed in some circles. Like, you have two people talking about what they want to do together, two people talking at the DM in character, and then one person, like, trying to ask an out-of-character question. It's like, okay, we need a speaking conch. Fucking one of you gets it at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's been one slight advantage of doing it on Zoom, is the way that people's mics cut each other out actually mm-hmm. kind of works out in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there have been a lot of moments where, like, people are making jokes at the table, and I'm like, are you saying that out loud to this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And that has kind of worked out in our favor in some ways, because our druid has super low charisma. So all of the, like, sarcastic jokes that my partner makes at the table turn out to just be, like, offensive things that the character says.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great way to keep it tied in, too.
Yeah. Another thing I did with that, I mentioned the chase sequence earlier after the abduction and mm-hmm. the Vistani camp. You know, the players wanted some time to, like, plan out their course of action. And while they were talking amongst themselves, I did some, like, one-on-one role playing with, the bard who had been kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the crew looked like they were ready and they had their plan, I looked at my watch and I was like, all right, so, they've got a 15-minute head start now because you've been talking for 15 minutes. And you're like, what? That was happening in real time? I'm like, yeah, guys.
Yeah, I was over here. We were talking. Like, yeah, what did you guys do?
Yeah. And, you know, it's got to be a balance because, like, you know, none of your players are actually a 10th level druid.
Yeah.
You know, none of them have the real combat experience of, like, you know, a level 6 barbarian to whom this is set like second nature.
Yeah.
So you have to allow a little bit, but it can get out of hand.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely can. But I think part of what helps with that is making sure that everyone, like, really knows their characters. And part of that just comes with playing and experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I'm one of those people who loves to just make characters that I know I'll probably never play. I've got like 40-something on D&D Beyond because I've got 5 minutes, I can whip up a character, you know?
Yep.
And so a lot of that comes with learning class abilities and skills and weird interactions between spells that, you know, like, I hold no illusions. Like, most players are never actually going to dedicate the amount of time and energy to it that mm-hmm. I do because I think it's fun. Like, that's just something that's entertaining for me.
Totally.
But at the same time, it's like, in creating and playing through higher level characters, there's a level of homework that I think some people get, like really get, and some people don't. You know, there's an understanding that has to come with like knowing how your spells work, knowing how they interact with your party in particular. In our Curse of Strahd campaign, I was playing a Sorlock. My partner is also playing a Druid. We discovered that the cheese grater effect of spike growth plus the push on Eldritch Blast. So we'd just like, we'd let someone run in, spike growth them right behind them, and then I would just go and cheese grater them straight back. And then I was like, well, if you want to keep coming at us, you can. You're just going to tear your limbs to shreds doing it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Oh, we used that combination like all the way through. What was his name? The mayor of Valaki? Yeah. He ended up crawling as his back melted from acid through a spike growth, trying to escape us.
Gnarly. After
trying to run out of town. Yeah, that was a particularly nasty one. We stopped his ceremony in the middle of town, and as he was trying to escape, we were just like, nah.
Oh, that's fucking great.
Yeah. May have accidentally started a riot. May have burned down the house, his house. May have never actually discovered his son that we found out about later, who also burned alive. We're the good guys.
Yay!
Yeah.
Yeah. I ended up killing him, you know, off screen. There was a point where after they had like rescued their friends, kidnapped by the Vistani, you know, they killed one of the two Vistani leaders, the one who's, you know, like, I think he was a bandit captain or something like that, whereas the other one was like a high level assassin. And so they had murdered this assassin's brother. And also, Ijek had figured out that Irina was taking refuge in the church, but he couldn't go in there. So there were these two loose ends that hadn't been tied up. So one night they're spending the night in Valaki, and the two of them try and assassinate them in their sleep. Of course, the party prevailed. At that point, like, well, Ijek was dead. Like, what power does the burgomaster have without Ijek? Meanwhile, they had, you know, when they took over the Voktor's estate, we said that, you know, they hired the guy who had previously been, like, managing their finances and taking their tithings. They hired him to like keep doing his job, but just give the money to them instead.
You're our tax collector now.
Yeah, pretty much. And in order to find the secret back entrance to the Voktor Manor, Ijek and Aragol, the assassin, you know, they like tortured Boris, the tax collector, and murdered him. And the party was like, oh no, they've like murdered our buddy. Like, what do we do? And so the druid did a resurrection ritual with him. And I was like, fuck it, let's roll the dice and see what he comes back as. And
reincarnation?
Reincarnation. Yeah. Came back as a tiefling. Which is like a 1 in 25 chance. And I was like, fuck it, this is perfect. And you know what? Since he was revived as a tiefling through like random magic, cool. Now he's a wild magic sorcerer.
Awesome.
And basically he took over the city. You know, late in the campaign, I like turned up the temperature and all the random encounters just because like shit was getting easy, and they get back to Valaki at one point and it's under siege, and they find Boris there like protecting it. And he was like, well, I just kind of like moved into the Burgomaster's mansion because no one else knew what the fuck they were doing. And I kind of run the place now.
He's like, well, you guys weren't here. So like, I mean, somebody has to handle the day to day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's excellent. How'd they take it?
When they first brought him back and were like hanging out in the basement of the Vachter mansion as he was like showing off his new powers and was like, yeah, maybe it's time for some new leadership around here, you know, it's like the Burgomaster, he's kind of ineffective. They were a little bit worried that he had come back with some like evil intentions as a tiefling.
That is racist.
Yeah. But no, it's turned out for the best in the end. They're quite happy that their trusted friend is now running the town.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good on them. Sometimes those little like decisions that you get to make as a party of like, yeah, we like this guy, we're gonna keep him around forever, end up being super important.
Yeah.
When those characters don't die horribly, at least.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes even if they do.
Yeah. Case in point, even if they do die horribly, maybe they come back as something more entertaining.
Yeah,
we did that with, in Tomb of Annihilation, we had a guy called Azaka, and we carried that poor woman through literally the entire campaign. The entire thing. She was scared of heights. We made her climb fucking Firefinger, which is this monstrous tower. It's like hundreds of feet high with a big flame on top. While being attacked by Terra folk, who are these like giant pteranodon people, like that one villain from Spider-Man back in the day. We made her like cross bridges over chasms. She like helped us break out of a pirate cove. She met gods. She like went into the dungeon with us at the end, barely survived, and ended up getting like the killing blow on. I'm not going to ruin the end of this campaign, but like on something very major.
Nice.
And at the end of it, we're just like, Azaka, 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 Azaka.
Nice.
Yeah. Those characters, we now have a, Steve made a Hero Forge miniature for her. Cause like, aww, she became that important to us. We're like, no, this is our friend. She's part of our crew.
Mm-hmm.
And in Curse of Strahd, we felt the same way about Irina. You know, she was just one of us, to the point where those characters ended up founding a school of magic back in the Faerun real world, mm-hmm, named St. Irina's School for Gifted Youngsters.
Aww.
The jumping off point for the next campaign.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. It's nice. It's amazing how attached you get to these like little figments of the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're kind of working with that right now with our paladin's steed. You know, like Pimpernel. How often does a fucking Pimpernel the pig? How often does a horse survive in a D&D campaign? Right, never. Right, like you're always fucking losing mounts all over the place. But like this pig was important.
Mm-hmm.
But we had talked early on about the pig getting killed off and coming back as like when the paladin casts Find Steed, he gets his pig back as like a ghost. Mm-hmm. You know, like there were a few times when I tried to kill him and you know, they managed to like save him at the last second.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other times when I could have concentrated fire on him in a way that just like didn't feel narratively right. It would have felt like just picking on him for, and so he stuck around, and they have since cast Awaken on him. So he is a sentient pig. And there was a point when I just kind of, you know, semi-randomly decided, well, like, you know, he is now a sentient pig who's been fighting alongside the party for these months. And like, just killed a pack of wolves while defending their horses while they were in the Amber Temple. Mm-hmm. Fuck it. He's a level one fighter now.
Yes.
I have created a fighter homebrew pig. Race in D&D Beyond, which is a sentient pig. we're still like trying to decide whether or not he should live through things. There's a certain amount of like narrative juiciness that comes from him not making it. But yeah. Everyone's like super, super attached to the pig. Sort of my long game with him right now is, as he has become sentient, he is starting to question why it is that beasts of burden are in eternal like servitude.
You go on Animal Farm?
I'm not going Animal Farm. Like, I don't want him to try and like rise up.
Okay.
I'm going more like animal liberation.
Uh-huh.
Have you watched the She-Ra reboot on Netflix?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah, so like her Pegasus unicorn.
Mm-hmm. Alicorn. Alicorn is the technical term.
Alicorn?
Yeah.
That is good to know.
Mm-hmm.
He's like similarly a animal liberation activist. So mm-hmm. I'm like taking notes from him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really fun. Level one fighter pig, animal rights activist. Still serving as a mount.
Yep.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Of course, making my life much harder as a DM mm-hmm. because now I have to RP a sentient pig. I'm still letting the player manage the combat, though. But this is another reason to maybe kill off the pig is because I've like, I've kind of made my bed for myself.
Yeah, you walked yourself right into a pig pen there.
Hey.
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum because you have you simultaneously have like a character class specific feature, right, in a mount that is central to their identity, right, that now is also an NPC under your direct purview, but simultaneously has to be something they can control.
Yeah, it's really tricky, and like trying to keep that balanced as well has been a bit tricky because in order to give the pig any staying power whatsoever, I have basically made him level in the way that a Beastmaster Ranger's animal companion would.
Mm-hmm.
That feels a little bit unfair because, I'm basically giving my paladin the benefits of a whole second class.
The weakest benefits of the weakest subclass.
I was about to say that Beastmaster Rangers are useless. Yeah.
It's pretty much not even a thing.
Yeah. And so now I'm having to figure out, like, okay, how do these two scalings work together? It's complicated, so I might just kill off the pig to make my life easy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like to make your life easier, maybe just giving, you might be able to even just give, if you think your player can do it well, give him a sheet with the character motivations of that pig now. Like, after you awaken it, it's no longer just your servant or your pet. It's a being, it's a friend, and it's currently disposed to be friendly towards you. Given that you've taken care of it well. Like its primary trait is loyalty. Like it wants to serve you. Its questions or like its bonds are loyalty to other animals. It's beginning to wonder why this is. It's having philosophic thoughts, you know? And then like its flaw is whatever you want its flaw to be. Like pick a random background. Give it a flaw that's kind of funny, but isn't going to be like game-breakingly destructive. Always wants to find truffles. Fuck it. Maybe it got distracted. But, and then at least it takes it off of your plate and you can kind of, at various points, course correct instead of having to oversee the entire NPC conversation elements of it. you know, you can be like, well, he's starting to think like this. And then if you give your player that, they can run with, basically, if you think they can handle having two characters, they can run with those interactions.
Yeah, that's definitely an option I've considered. I think at least for the meantime, I want to keep control of them, especially because that player is now considering, he kind of wants to do a like fall and redemption arc for his paladin. And if I get to keep control of the pig, then it becomes this like, you know, your best friend tries to have an intervention sort of thing.
Totally. Oh my God, what if he kills the pig?
That would be very dramatic.
That would be so dramatic.
Yeah.
That would be a whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
Like,
oh man.
You know, it's like your friend's trying to snap you out of like a drug haze and you're just like, come on, man, I know you're not doing this. You're better than this. We can, come on, we just got to get up. We just got to keep moving. Fucking stab him. And you wake up 2 days later in an inn surrounded by fucking wine bottles and who knows what else. And you're like, Pimpernel! And then the rest of your friends have to tell you what happened. Oh boy, that's a fall.
Yeah. Oh man, I am putting that one in my back pocket.
Yeah, save that.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Also, we should probably put a disclaimer at the beginning of this episode. Be like, if a pig named Pimpernel means anything to you, fuck right off, right now.
Yeah. I was already thinking that if we get into talking about my plans for where I'm taking the campaign from here, I was going to stop and say, like, all right, if you're in part of my party, like, please stop watching now. But, you know, cat's out of the bag.
Yeah. Well, we'll just put it at the beginning. Well, after we're done, we'll record that and then put it at the beginning in the editor. We'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
Do it in post.
Yeah. We'll do it in post. We can do everything in post.
Yeah.
So your party hasn't actually completed Curse of Strahd yet, right?
No. They finished the quest of the trees, and they just like swung by Mount Baratok to pick up the Mad Mage, and now they are beelining for Ravenloft.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like getting into the final assault time.
Yep. I've got to spend some time studying up on Ravenloft. I'm not sure how much they're going to want to like explore the castle versus beelining straight to, you know, the location of the encounter. When they were in the Amber Temple, they found the architect's room, the room of the guy who like designed
the whole fucking design, the whole.
And the druid has keen mind.
So she can remember everything.
And so I was like, all right, well, yeah, it takes you a few hours of studying, but you have memorized the entire layout of the castle. And I just handed my partner the like map insert and was like, you don't know what any of the rooms are, but here's the map.
That's fun.
Yeah.
But of course, that probably doesn't include like all the secret doors.
Yeah, I suppose not.
Those would be pretty hard to detect, even in that miniature scale.
For sure.
So that'll be interesting. Even if, like, when we ran it, we tried to beeline to a couple of places, and we got fucked. We were like, okay, we know exactly where we're going, because we've been here before, and we still ended up, like, sliding through, like, it's like, oop, there's a pit trap there. That leads to, like, 3 floors down. Congratulations. What was supposed to be a 10-minute jaunt is now like a 3-day fucking slog.
And I gotta find ways of like diverting them like that, throwing in some beefier encounters, because like I've given my party was complaining about the absence of like nice magic loot in Barovia. And so I've given them some pretty nice magic loot. You know, honestly, I've kind of been having fun just like turning up the temperature on all the encounters.
Yeah, crank that shit to 11, man. Like, if you start giving out like if a party ends up with enough game-changing magic items, you know, like the ones that really let you cast like weird spells or neutralize situations entirely, that's when it's like, yeah, okay, we're just gonna crank that shit up to a net bit.
Yep. And you know, I definitely did that with the Trees of the Four Seasons quest.
Mm-hmm.
The reward, well, there's two rewards at the end of the quest. One of them is that it breaks Strahd's control of the weather over the valley.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah, so like sunlight returns.
That changes literally everything.
Totally, yeah. Although I did have the blanket of cloud remain above Ravenloft itself.
Mm-hmm. Because so he can still occupy his own space.
Yeah, otherwise I'm fucked as a DM. Yeah. But the other reward is something called the Staff of the Woodlands.
Yep, great item.
Super great. Honestly, think it might be worthy of making very rare instead of just rare.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it, on the one hand, it feels a little bit OP for a 10th level party. On the other hand, like, it is a very long and involved side quest that has spanned almost the entire duration of our campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it deserved like a pretty meaty reward.
Yeah, absolutely. For something that's taken that long.
Yeah, and so, you know, like, I'm just going to make Strahd harder. He's going to get max hit points, and they're going to run into him accompanied by Bucephalus and Rahadin, and also, I think player. I may have... so there's four 10th level players, and also there's someone who's 8th level. I tried pulling a friend into the campaign, playing a cleric, and scheduling didn't work out, so I NPC'd his player and have brought him back with someone else playing him.
Nice.
They've managed to handle everything I've thrown at them so far. The other chunk that I'm throwing into the encounter with Strahd is, I think I told you that I murdered their bard and have brought him back as a vampire.
Yep.
He's going to be part of that encounter as well. But he's going to dip out as soon as he starts taking any kind of serious damage because he's going to become one of the like major villains once they get back to Wildemount.
Cool.
I've got a bunch of plans for where that's going.
You know, you could probably add in a betrayer arc there for him too, for that NPC now, to be like, his reason for dipping out is to steal one of Strahd's sources of power, to then become more powerful, like, to then become a major enemy. So he's got a reason to, like...
That's already sort of happened. They first re-encountered, at that point, the vampire spawn version of their friend in the Amber Temple.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up and sang a song that I wrote. Then as he is talking to the now enchanted party, Rahadin walks up and just kind of says like, hey, we've been here way longer than we were supposed to be. You have taken more gifts than were supposed to come to you. Cut it out with this stupid game of cat and mouse. We're getting out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And what that was alluding to, which they haven't put together yet, was he took two gifts while in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the gift that permanently boosts his charisma by 2 points.
Yeah, Xantris the Kingmaker.
Yeah, because, like, he's a bardlock. Like, of course he's going to take that.
That was my Sorlock's grandfather.
Yeah. The other one was he also took the dark gift of the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And then, likewise, they haven't figured out why this has happened yet. While they were away from the Wizard of Wines, that guy came back and murdered Esmeralda, who thought he was a babe and was like pretty into him, and that's how you like seal the pact. Mm-hmm. So he's already doing that, like, you know, he's got ambitions beyond Strahd. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the Amber Temple, I dropped a statue of Lolth into the room with the main sarcophagi.
Yep.
And so he's going to become, like, you know, a prophet of Lolth type thing.
Cool. That's going to be fun. That's going to be real fun.
Mm-hmm. It's nice, like, tying that into the player's backstory. You know, we've spent some time, like, putting some flesh on those bones, moving into the next phase of the campaign. So he grew up in the Menagerie Coast. His mother was a drow bard, mm-hmm. Who was murdered by bandits. And, you know, his dad made his mom this, like, really nice magic flute, which I dropped in Strahd's castle just in case they found it. And now the vampire version of him has it. And the bard is still alive, well, not alive, but his soul is trapped in a ring of mind shielding.
Oh, Zuko!
Yeah. This is Zuko.
Zuko.
So the bard in the ring is like, what the fuck? How did he get my mom's flute?
Mm-hmm.
But the backstory that the player doesn't know is that his mom was raised in a cult of Lolth in the Underdark, and was prophesied to give birth to the one who is going to bring Lolth back. And so she escaped to try and stop it, and then she was murdered by Vistani, who were trying to, like, bring her back for Strahd, who was working with Lolth and for Lolth. And then he got sucked into the valley while looking for her and trying to figure out, like, who are these bandits? And while he himself would never have gone that direction, his murdered vampire corpse 100% will.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
I love the convoluted story elements that us DMs end up weaving together. It's like, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this. Wah!
Yeah. No, it's been really fun ramping up for post-Barovia because, you know, like, as is common for campaigns, people come in with, like, very bare-bones backstories, like, pretty minimalist, more just like, I want to play a rogue who's also, you know, a halfling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have, like, you know, oh, he's a folk hero, so, like, there was a thing that happened in his village.
Mm-hmm.
And now being like, all right, Boffin, well, you are a folk hero halfling who grew up in a farming village. Well, clearly you're from Felderwind, mm-hmm. or, you know, the tillage outside Felderwind. Mm-hmm. So you had this, you know, heroic thing happen in your hometown. You developed a connection with a god. You went to Felderwind to try and figure out what's going on with it. Felderwind has a pretty minimal temple district, so you went to the next big city, Zadash, to continue exploring, and Zadash is where the party got shanghaied to Barovia.
Yep.
So, like, really deepening those motivations and making room to have the next phase of the campaign not only be more, like, narratively dramatic, but also have a lot more, like, personal tie-ins.
Yeah. That's one of the things with Barovia is it really strips a lot of those personal tie-ins because unless you're playing, like, a Grey Elf or Barovian citizen, mm-hmm. like, you got nothing here, you know? Yeah. You're just ripped out of your home, dropped into this plane, and given the most bare bones of instructions, which are basically, if you run Death House, it's, here's some ghosts, here's some horror, you own this weird windmill outside of town, if you found that, mm-hmm. and good luck surviving for the rest of ever.
Mm-hmm.
Have fun.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty good time. We are running up on just about an hour. I'm going to wrap this segment.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, we kind of touched on the quest of the Four Seasons. And I wanted to just, like, if it's all right with you, give a little bit more detail. I kind of gave the, like, background lore, but wanted to kind of describe some. The idea is that, you know, when Strahd became a vampire, took over the valley, and it was banished to the demiplane of Dread, he cut down the four trees in order to give himself the power to control the weather in the valley. So the ultimate goal of the quest is to restore the four trees and break that control. So the locations of the four trees, the Oak of Summer is on Yester Hill. The Gulfius tree is growing out of like the ruin of the oak. And they can find an acorn nearby and, you know, channeling 3 8-hour castings of plant growth into it, it restores the oak. Willow of
a lot. 3 8-hour castings of plant growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Concentrated into a single plant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it grows
an oak. How many random encounters did they run into over the course of that?
I let them have it, you know. Okay. Yeah, you know.
My personal DM style? Oh, man, they've been fighting for every single one of those.
I'm generous, you know.
I'm a generous god.
Yeah. So the Willow of Spring grew next to Tsair Pool. The stump of the Willow of Spring is Baba Lee Saga's creeping hut.
PTSD from that fucking hut at all. Nope.
No.
It didn't try to eat my face.
That was a brutal encounter.
Yeah.
She came and put the gem from the Wizard of Wines into it, and it like up and walks away and becomes the hut. So upon defeating Baba Lee Saga and removing the gem, while most of the stump is still dead, the area immediately around the gem has developed enough life to where a cutting can be taken.
Replant it.
Yep. Same thing, 3 8-hour castings. The Maple of Autumn is there's a hill north of Lake Veritok, kind of by the werewolf den.
Yep.
It's on the north side of that. When they get to that area, there is an amber golem, a like cracked amber golem with half hit points, that is guarding the site. Again, there is the ruined and burned stump of the maple. And curiously, there's these like ancient wooden scaffoldings supporting some troughs that lead down from the side of the tree into big open rectangular pits. It's kind of silly, but I am Canadian. The sap from the tree was cast into these pits, and that is what built the Amber Temple.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah. The Amber Golem, which is cracked, it has a maple seed in its chest, which is powering it, but it is cracked to the point where it can no longer be used to plant the tree. So to get the usable seed, they have to go to the Amber Temple. The golem that is guarding the treasure room has another seed in its chest.
Cool.
So they defeat that, take the seed. Pine of Winter was by far the silliest of them. It was our you know, Yule time special.
Christmas one shot.
Yeah, Christmas one shot. So, you know, a snowstorm envelops the valley. With a driving, unrelenting wind coming from the peak of Mount Baratok. It's extremely unnatural. It doesn't change directions. It's just constant. So the players follow up to the top of Mount Baratok, And as they reach the summit, there is a clan of Yetis guarding the peak, with an abominable Yeti as the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And an especially perceptive character will notice that tied to the stump of the old pine tree, there's this rope that just leads straight up into the sky. This is based off of something I saw in the Caribbean once, where I came to this rock and there was just a string going out over the ocean. And then I was like, what the hell is it? And I pull it in and there's a kite on the end of the string, like, you know, like so far out, I can barely see it.
Uh-huh.
I like bent the rules a little bit to allow them to speak to the Yetis via speak with animals. They learn that
Yetis, their own language, right? They
speak Yeti. Yeah. Yeti is a language, yeah. Which for our campaign came in the form of Wookiee noises. It's a nod to the Star Wars Christmas special.
Yep, the best movie ever made.
Oh my God, so good. Harrison Ford, if you're watching, I'm not sorry. but yeah, they were the guardians of the tree, and they explained that the life cycle is that the cone has to go through a hard freeze for the nuts to come out. But there is only one cone left, which Strahd, as a cruel joke, formed into a snow globe. And this magic snow globe, when you shake it, makes wind blow and snowfall in Barovia.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Yetis figured that if they made a hard freeze on this snow globe, maybe they could get a seed out. So what they did was they tied the globe to a kite and shook it to bring the wind up, and then the kite starts picking up and the kite goes way up into the sky. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this self-perpetuating machine.
Mm-hmm, it's just shaking.
Yeah. Because, you know, in the dismal land of Barovia, there's no more winter because all of the seasons are the same.
Yeah.
So, like San
Francisco, it's just kind of foggy, misty.
Yeah.
Vaguely shitty.
Yeah. So they pull down the snow globe, and inside is a perfect replica of Barovia, but with one exception, which is that the Pine of Winter is still on top of Mount Baratok.
Mm.
By gazing into the snow globe, they get sucked inside. They're able to pull a cone off of the miniature pine and bring it back to the outside world. And that's how you get that.
That is a truly epic quest series. And I think honestly, your rewards are right in line.
It's a very long and involved quest, and it felt like it should come with a big reward.
Yeah.
Again, I hope that other people enjoy this. If you have a druid in your party, it works super well. It might also be able to work with an Oath of the Ancients paladin or a life cleric.
Mm-hmm. Like, even just a particularly involved ranger.
Yeah. You would have to change the magic item drop, because Staff of the Woodlands requires attunement by a druid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this can be modified to work with a different party makeup.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Any of our paid subscribers get to see Zuko right now. He's the cutest.
Yeah, he's my little Jack Russell blue healer puppy. It's about 6 months old. Subscribe to the Patreon for cute puppies.
Yeah, and adorable kittens, although not right now because mine have abandoned me.
No.
they're all in my partner's office.
friend. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
That's been fucking fantastic. It's been great to have you. I'd love to have you back, and next time maybe we can talk about this amazing speed rail bed and Kinbaku practices.
Yeah, you know, the bed is quite a magical thing, and also one thing we didn't get to touch on today was the relationship between crafting narratives and encounters in D&D with scene craft, and especially my love of, like, highly ritualized scene craft.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to come back on and talk some more at a future date.
Absolutely. Those are two things that I particularly enjoy, especially for me in the auditory. I love creating like deeply involved and mostly terrifying playlists for my both types of sessions, because there's something really rewarding about watching a group of people viscerally react to just the sounds that are happening around them as you describe a worldscape, whether in the imaginative world or in the "do you see this" kind of world. So yeah,
looking forward to it. Yeah,
absolutely. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay sane, and roll high.
Yeah, wash your hands.
Yeah.